Well, good evening, and welcome everyone to this edition of Narsil in Action. I'm Larry, and I'm accompanied with my fabulous co-host, Andy, who is with us tonight, and most of you would know him from the Registry Matters podcast. Andy will be assisting with production this evening, and is the responsible party if you have any complaints about the technical quality.
Thanks. I see a bus coming.
Tonight's program will be for a total of 3 hours. During the first hour, we'll be discussing the registration process in Colorado, which we did last month. Hour two will be, can they do that? And we're going to have two attorneys tonight for hour two. That'll be Colleen Kelly and Jennifer Burrell. Get it right here in a second. During that segment, we will try to answer your questions about whether probation officers or registry tracking officers can lawfully impose what seem like really weird and possibly unconstitutional requirements. Hour three will be a continuation of can they do that if we haven't taken all the questions. And then we're going to focus on why attorneys plea bargain. And that's going to be primarily Ms. Jennifer Burrell from New Mexico. And we're going to have probably King Alexander, one of our regulars, pop in at some point. There'll be 5-minute breaks at the top of each hour because none of us can sit here for 3 hours, nor do we expect you to, without stretching your legs and doing necessary things. So we will have some promotional messages, and then when we're ready to begin, you'll hear the new sounder that you just heard. We did experience some technical issues last month, which we think are fully resolved. And we had some feedback that we had fading in and out from some listeners, and that they would like to have had the opportunity to clearly hear what Ms. Kelly had to say. And we invited her back, and she willingly accepted. So we're gonna do a repeat of the program. It'll be very similar questions to what we've asked before. Those of you that heard it in its entirety without any problem and you don't have any questions, you may want to pop in again in the second and third hour. We're not asking you to leave, but just letting you know we're going to largely cover the same questions that people didn't hear last time. And we're going to go through those again. And then we're going to take questions from you, the listeners. Ms. Kelly started her practice many years ago. I think, what was it, 9 years ago with the Colorado Public Defender's Office. And she worked for several years in the Castle Rock office. And then while with the Public Defender's Office, she represented hundreds, if not thousands, of clients in juvenile court, district court, county court, and urban and rural jurisdictions. And thank you, Ms. Kelly. Welcome again for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me. Thank you.
So I don't hear you breaking up so far like we had last month. It sounds really strong. So hopefully we have no problems tonight. And so let's go over Colorado Revised Statute 16-22-113, which permits a person to petition for deregistration. Can you, in a nutshell, in 12 seconds, tell us who's eligible and how long the person must register before they can file a petition? I'm joking about the 12 seconds, but yes, let's go through the eligibility for that.
Okay, well, first, you have to be eligible to begin with. And the way that you become eligible is to have a conviction that qualifies. So there's only a couple that are excluded, and they mainly fall under the sex assault on a child or sex assaults. And so once you're eligible, there's a requisite waiting period. And the waiting period after you're finished with your sentence varies for offenses. So for class 1, 2, or 3 felony, 20 years. Class 4, 5, 6 felony, you have to wait 10 years. For a class 1 misdemeanor, you have to wait 10 years as well. And other misdemeanors is a 5-year waiting period. If you've completed a deferred sentence or a deferred adjudication for juveniles, then you can petition immediately after the successful completion when your case is dismissed. And then there's another, sort of odd exception for a sex trafficking charge if you have proof that you were being trafficked by another person, and that's also immediate. So what people frequently overlook is that these waiting periods do start from the end of the person's sentence, meaning the date of discharge from Department of Corrections or probation or parole or basically the final release of the jurisdiction from the court, and that's when the waiting period starts.
So for example, if you had a long period of supervision of 10 years, 15 years, none of that is accruing toward that wait period. You're registering all that time and then your time begins at the end of that from that discharge point.
Unfortunately, yes. Exactly. If you do have that long period, it really extends the time that you're going to be registering.
Okay, you briefly touched on some offenses that are not. Can you drill a little bit more of those that are just not eligible, so the people that fit outside that will know who they are? What is just not eligible for the petition?
Sure. And the difficult part where it gets confusing on this one is there's some convictions under old statutes. So that's sort of something that you're going to have to consult a lawyer on. But sex assault, so any person that's been designated as a sexually violent predator is not going to be eligible. And then anyone who's been convicted in Colorado of very specific offenses, so sexual assault on a child, sexual assault position of trust, sexual assault on a client by a psychotherapist, incest, aggravated incest, and also people who have been convicted of similar offenses in other states. So if it matches and what incest is in the state of Colorado, then you would be ineligible, even though it's an out-of-state conviction.
So when we talk about those that cannot file, so the Colorado offenses that cannot file, if they have a Colorado offense, which were those again? Because I'm a little fuzzy on it. Which Colorado, the sexually violent designation, and which other offenses under Colorado law will prohibit you from the get-go?
Oh, sure. And that would be a sexual assault. Sexual assault on a child, sexual assault on a child by a person in a position of trust, sexual assault by on a client by a psychotherapist, incest and aggravated incest are the designated offenses.
I'm getting a little bit of a delayed from what you're saying, and it sounds like she's fading in and out. I don't know if Andy, if you're hearing that, but I can work with it. I just want to let you know. Can a person, let me just make a comment. We posted after your last visit, we posted a wrap up of what happened, and comments flowed in a few about it. And one of the persons said that he didn't see that the value was worth a petition to get off. He said, because there are all these private registries are out there, and that he really thought it was kind of smoke and mirrors. He didn't use those words, but that was it. Inference. And I wrote back, or my response was, well, if you think the private websites are the same as registration, I've got news for you. They're not. You're on a private website, and I'm talking about these private companies. I'm not talking about a private website. If HomeFacts has you listed as a person on a convicted of a sex offense, that's not anything near the same thing as facing a felony prosecution for forgetting to report in within the time frame of your birthday, nor does it prohibit you from living within exclusionary zones, nor does it prohibit you from traveling without giving advance notice. And there's on and on and on about things that deregistering is a beneficial. So I just thought you probably didn't see the comment or my response, but do you have any thoughts on that? When you say that it's not worth a petition to deregister, there's a whole lot of collateral consequences that go away when you're not required to be registered. You're not. In some states, it can be a habitual enhancement because it's a multiple felony conviction. If you violate registration in my state, it cannot be enhanced. There's no habitual for that. But you can end up in prison for a very long period of time. So I would think there'd be enormous value in deregistering.
I agree. I think there's a huge value. The first is just mentally. I think that especially for some people who are registering for long periods of time, there's just such a great weight off their shoulders that they're not confined to that they don't have to appear at a certain time. In regards to the private website comment, that it is true. Some of these companies have obtained lists and they publish them sort of even if they're outdated. But if you are no longer a registered sex offender and someone is posting false information, you can contact that company or that website and ask them to take it down because they're posting false information. Now, I don't know if you want to go so far as to file a suit against them if they refuse, but they can't post false information about you. So that's there are a lot of benefits.
Well, and I was telling the person as well that as far as I know, the enforcement of IML is if you're not registering, then you don't fall within the category of people who get that marking on your passport. I would think that would hold some value to not have your passport marked, but maybe that's just me. But can a person file this petition on their own without an attorney? Is that permissible in Colorado?
Excuse me. Sure. Yeah. You can. There's no requirement under the law that you have to have an attorney file a petition like this for you. However, a lot of my clients are people that have come to me after a failed attempt. And sometimes it's because the judge rejects it just out of hand. Sometimes it's because they haven't complied with some of the requirements under the law because they don't understand them. So for me, And because it's complex, there are even attorneys that don't understand the procedure. So I'm always going to recommend that you go through an attorney. I think it will be quicker. It will be more likely to succeed as well. You really want someone there holding the judge accountable for following what the actual law is. So that's why I'd recommend an attorney to handle something like this for you.
Well, a person has a conviction in Boulder County, and they're living way down in La Plata County in the Four Corners area, right on the New Mexico-Colorado line. Where do they file their petition at?
Well, for a Colorado conviction, you're always going to have to file in the court where you are convicted. So if the conviction was in Boulder County, you have to file with the same exact court, same case number.
So this is an action within the criminal case. You would file a petition within that case number in Boulder County. Well, of course, that begs the question, what about people who have non-Colorado convictions? What do they do?
Sure. For a person who's moved to Colorado after a conviction in another state, if you fall under the general guidelines where you're allowed to petition as you register in Colorado, you can file a civil action. And you'd file a civil action in the county where you live. You'd file it in the district court, and you'd ask that court to issue an order regarding your out-of-state conviction. This is going to be even more complex. So this is where judges and attorneys and the district attorney are always going to be arguing back and forth about how that's done. But it's complicated because you have to make a comparison to an out-of-state conviction. And all the state laws have different language and different conditions for what constitutes a sex offense or a sexual assault or, you know, indecent exposure or things like that. And you really want to be able to make the argument that you would fall under the most lenient deregistration restrictions, meaning if you can make an argument that it's a lesser offense in Colorado, you'd be eligible much earlier. So that can be a benefit there in getting an attorney to assist you.
Well, let's say, for example, my state has fewer felony levels than Colorado, but let's just pluck out Arkansas as an example. We have degree felonies first, second, third. Arkansas has a class D felony. That's as low as they go. So you would come in and you would look at that Class D felony and look at the language and you would argue, try to unpack that, how you would convert that to a Colorado offense, because people want it to be simpler than what it actually is. So the Class D felony from Arkansas, it needs to translate to one of these waiting periods in Colorado, which you said like a Class 1 or 2 or 3 is 20 years. Well, if you just magically said a Class D was a Class 4, then that would get you in a 10-year wait. But would it be as magic as going down to say, gee, a D is a Class 4 felony, or would there be more intricacy to figuring out what a Class D Arkansas felony would translate to in Colorado?
There really isn't a specific rule on it, so you just have to make the argument. So what I would do is I'd look at a Class D felony out of Arkansas, and I'd look at what the punishment is, right? So is it a Class 6, you know, is it comparable to a Class 6 felony in Colorado, where the maximum prison sentence is 18 months, right? Or is it comparable to a Class, you know, 4 felony where the maximum is going to be 6 years? So
okay,
let's start there.
In that case, go ahead.
You'd also have to look at the specific charge. and whether the charge is similar. So in some states, for instance, I think California and Colorado have almost identical laws on indecent exposure. So it's the same thing. They call it something different. So I think it's a, class B felony or something like that. But the language of the statute is identical. So you do that comparison as well, and you try to make the argument, well, this is, this would count as this charge in Colorado, and this charge is this level of felony, and so go under those rules. You'd make the argument that way.
Well, the big question is for people out there, okay, I want to get off. What's this thing going to cost me? So you've done a number of these, and I'm sure you've communicated with attorneys who do these petitions. You can only speak for yourself, but what is a person typically going to be experiencing in the way of attorney's fees to try to navigate this process?
Well, the cost is going to depend on the attorney that you hire, the firm that you hire, the complexity of your particular case. For example, if it's very straightforward and it was and the records are very clear, it's not going to take that much time. The attorney, if they've done this before, can do it very quickly. I think a cost of around $3,000 to $5,000 is what I tell people to expect, and the cost increases if you're, a distance from your attorney, or if you have to make these difficult comparisons, if there's a lot of records to review that you're going to use in preparation for your hearing. But I think $5,000 is probably about the most I would expect something like this to cost in in the most complex situation.
You have your initial consultation with a person, and they convince you that they're eligible, that they've waited the requisite time, they've got their discharge papers. Do you recommend a particular steps be taken before you actually file the petition to enhance its success? There's a list of things, a checklist that you're going to go through and say, well, you haven't done that. You need to do this. Is there something, or do you just run in and file it when they say, I've got the $5,000?
No, and I always actually charge a really minimal fee to my clients just to review their file initially to make sure that I think they actually are eligible, and then to give them advice beyond eligibility as to whether they should file it, meaning whether I think they're likely to succeed. And that depends on their individual case. So I don't think that there's a lot, excuse me, that I'm recommending that everyone do to prepare for this. Finding your records and keeping your records up until you're going to file it is about the best advice I can give. So for someone that knows that they're going to be eligible in such number of years, they really need to be hanging on to their treatment records and their probation records, and especially if they've gone through sex offender treatment and successfully completed that. That's the most important piece of paperwork. Occasionally, when someone hasn't completed treatment for whatever reason, and there are a million reasons why someone doesn't before the end of their sentence, occasionally I'm going to be recommending that someone do a renewed sex offense specific evaluation, but that's really going to be on a case-by-case basis. They're fairly expensive, and we want to make sure that that money is well spent for someone that actually is going to have some effect on their petition before we go ahead and do that.
So we've touched on out of state convictions a little bit. Let's do a hypothetical here. Some states register all indecent exposure, and some register aggravated, the more serious indecent exposure, where there's an exposure to a minor. Suppose a person moves to Colorado with an out of state conviction, and they're registering in a state that registers a broad universe of sex offenses, and maybe Colorado doesn't cover that. Let's do the question two ways. They don't cover that, so they would come to you, and could you help them get off the registry if they have a non-covered offense? And how would you do that? And then if it is covered, then the deregistration process dissect the difference in between it with an in-state. So there's a minor charge for obscene phone calls or something that they're having to register for. They show up in Colorado, they report to the registration office because Alabama told them if you don't check in within 3 days, we'll put a warrant out for you. So they go to register, but they don't think they should have to register. How can you help in a case like that?
And I'll tell you that this is where people get caught up the most, is, you know, they'll come here and sometimes they're given misinformation. Sometimes, you know, the sheriff wherever they are, or the police officer in whatever local department will say, well, it doesn't have to look like you have to register. So I always tell people to be careful about that when they're moving to a different state, is make sure you consult an attorney, because just because someone told you you didn't have to, sometimes you really do under the law. And one of the tricks that people miss is if you have to register in another state. So if you're registering in Alabama for something, where even in Colorado, that the same offense wouldn't be something that you would have to register for, the fact that you still have to register in Alabama triggers a registration requirement in Colorado. But at that point, you would have to register in Colorado, and then you would have to petition to deregister, saying basically that under Colorado law, you wouldn't be required, or you've passed the time bar. Did that answer your question, Larry, what you were getting to?
Yes, kind of. So Colorado really has an unequal law. Then if obscene phone calls register in Alabama and Colorado doesn't register that, they would still register you for them because of Alabama's requirement. My state doesn't do it that way. It has to be an equivalent offense. It has to be something that would trigger registration under our state law. It has to be truly an equivalent to a sex offense that would trigger a duty to register here. So you get into Colorado.
Yeah, and I'm aware there's a couple other states that actually have the same language, and I think North Carolina, if I'm not mistaken, is one of them, where it basically says if you would have to register in the other state, then you have to register here.
And that's what I was thinking. You were saying about Colorado that you would have to register simply because Alabama requires it for that offense, whether or not it's equivalent to something in Colorado. Is that correct, or do I have it wrong?
Well, that's correct. But you can then petition to deregister. As silly as that seems. That's how the law is written.
And then the basis of the petition is it's not an equivalent offense. Is that the way it goes?
Yeah, that would be the argument.
Okay. Okay. Well, assuming it is an equivalent offense, then the out-of-state conviction, they have some luxury because they don't have a court of conviction to file in, so they can file in wherever they're living.
They would have to file a civil case
in whatever county that they've chosen to live in, which would provide them the opportunity to be somewhat selective if they had an idea of which counties would be more likely to release them from registration.
Sure.
You see where I'm going?
Yeah. And I wish I had statistics. Unfortunately, that'd be a little bit too big a project for me personally. I wish I had statistics on, you know, how many petitions were filed and what basis they were getting granted or denied. But I will tell you that having filed petitions in Denver, in Boulder, in some of the bigger jurisdictions, they're more used to seeing them. They understand the procedure. They're sympathetic to people who have been registering and who have been registering for a number of years and have had no issues. And they've seen the hardships that are caused by registration for individuals and their families. So for me, that frequency of seeing how it affects people and understanding that the law is written for a reason and it's to reward people who have basically done their time. I think some of the smaller jurisdictions don't see a lot of these petitions, and so I think they struggle with them a lot more. And that would be my observation on that. The more rural jurisdictions are going to be a bigger challenge for us sometimes.
Well, and then plus there would be the travel. Since you're in Denver Metro, Colorado's a pretty large geographic territory to cover, which would put you traveling. But I intuitively, although we don't have that process here, intuitively I would think that the more they see these petitions, that's proven in the. I was doing some study on the civil commitment process in Virginia, and we looked at. I didn't do the work. I just looked at the results because we were writing a statement at NARSL about civil commitment. The jurisdictions that don't see any of those petitions for civil commitment grant the attorney general every civil commitment petition that's filed because they've seen three in the history of the program. And then jurisdictions like Richmond, where they see quite a few of them, they are a lot more comfortable in saying, no, you haven't met the burden that's required to civilly commit this person. And I would think the same thing would hold true in deregistration. If the urban areas have deregistered people and all life as they know it hasn't ended, and the judge hasn't been voted out of office because of it, then I think they would be a little more lenient with granting the petitions. But leads to the next question: who bears the burden of proving what? Who has to prove what to get off? Does the registrant have to prove something, or does the state have to prove something, or does anyone know? Is it just all up in the air and all over the place?
Oh gosh, I wish I could answer that question. So the statute has recently been amended just a little bit, and I think it's sort of changed the game. So previously, it was really clear that there wasn't a burden of proof, right? It basically just said, you know, the court can consider these things. After the person is eligible, they can look at these types of things. And there's a recent case that we talked about last time. It's Millard v. Rankin. And one of the issues, and that's the case where the district court judge issued a ruling saying that the registration statute was unconstitutional as applied to the three petitioners, to the three plaintiffs. And part of the reason that the Judge Mache had identified as what was unfair, basically, is that there really wasn't a burden of proof. And in these deregistration hearings, judges were imposing a burden on these people to show that they weren't a risk, right? That they weren't a risk to reoffend. And the problem was that wasn't a requirement of the statute. So it really left it to the judge's discretion. So really, really recently, August, I think, went into effect August 8th of this year. They changed the language just a tiny bit. And what they've added into the statute is that in determining whether to grant the petition, the judge should consider all of these things, but also that the judge is to consider whether the petitioner is not likely to commit a subsequent offense involving unlawful sexual behavior. So I think what they're trying to do is what the legislature has tried to do is try to add that burden of proof, to try to make the petitioner prove somehow that they're not likely to commit a subsequent sexual offense. And I frankly don't know how you prove that you're not going to do something in the future. So that's a pretty high burden. But I think hopefully the judges are going to recognize that the only way you can really prove that is to show that there has been a period of time where you haven't been committing any offenses.
So, well, our Colorado people submitted some questions, and then we're going to go to audience. But the question, which follows nicely, one of the plaintiffs in the Millard v. Rankin case had petitioned twice, been denied twice. And the judges said they had no assurance that the person would not reoffend. And in fact, one of the records, one of the plaintiff's records had been destroyed by the juvenile, whatever they call the child services people, that had been destroyed. And the Colorado group wants to know, is it your opinion that the judges are just not wanting to take a chance on making a mistake? A distrust of the registrant, or is the system fundamentally flawed? I tend to think the system was fundamentally flawed, and Judge Mates thought that. But do you think the system is just fundamentally flawed, even with the changes that they've made?
Yeah, well, I think in terms of this, the way that this law is written, I think that it allows judges too much discretion, and. You know, the judges, Judge Mache actually had a lot of, you know, I call it having a lot of balls. I mean, that's, you know, that was a brave decision where he recognized that something was wrong and he called it like it is. So judges, otherwise, I think a lot of times are trying to cover their own self. They, if they can deny something and let you, you know, fight it out in the higher courts, that's sometimes what they're going to do. You know, unless there's somebody standing up, sitting next to you and standing up for you, I think they tend to deny things because they don't want it. They don't want it to come back to them. You know, in the case of a judge that gives a really lenient sentence to someone on, you know, something like a DUI offense, And that person goes out and, you know, gets drunk and kills a family in a car accident, that's going to come back on that judge. And the same thing here, if they were to grant a petition to deregister to someone and then they went out and committed another offense, well, there would be an enormous amount of backlash. So I think that's the issue where judges are thinking about denying things. And that's the reason sometimes.
Well, I'm going to take a moment to catch everybody up to speed. You're listening to An Arsenal in Action with Colleen Kelly, private attorney in Denver, Colorado. And we've talked a couple of things that people out of state may not be aware of. The Millard v. Rankin is a case that's in federal court. It's actually in the U.S. Court of Appeals for the 10th Circuit. And the district judge, Mache, did declare Colorado's registration unconstitutional as applied to the plaintiffs. I believe there were three of them. And so that's what Ms. Kelly is talking about. We are going to take a couple, ask a couple more questions, and then we're going to take listener questions. The Colorado attorney, Maureen Kane, has a grant for years that helps people get off the registry. One of the things she's run into while trying to assist people get off the registry is people come from to Colorado from other states. This year, the grant disallows out-of-state folks from being part of the clinic and from getting pro bono help from the CCDB, the Colorado Criminal Defense Bar Volunteer Attorneys. What makes out-of-state deregistration more challenging? And we've covered a little bit, but if you could just highlight that, those things that make it all the work you have to do as opposed to a regular person, and maybe give some idea why they would close that resource available to out-of-state people.
And I don't know what prompted that decision. But I will tell you, it's just that more difficult analysis. I can't go to the judge and say, this is this offense, and this offense is this class felony, and therefore it's eligible on this date. The attorney or the petitioner has to go back through, and they have to pull up the out-of-state law from whatever time period that they were convicted. They have to dig up an old record and see what subsection they were convicted under. And sometimes that's impossible. After 10 years, a lot of courthouses will destroy records, so you can't even find what the conviction was for. You can find a general sense, but sometimes there's two different sections, and one involves sexual gratification and one doesn't. I'm thinking of indecent exposure in a couple states. And so those, depending on what subsection, it would really make a difference. And you just have to do so much more legwork to make that argument. That's what I think that's about.
And my personal opinion is that no state wants another state's offenders to come there, or this type of offender anyway. And I think that the extra work, and we don't want to be a floodgate opening that could possibly be lurking in people's minds as well, that, you know, we've got enough to do with our own people, and these people are piling in here with these complicated cases, and they can go get off in their own jurisdiction. The lifetime supervision statute in Colorado is very heinous, and I don't think you do have that much lobbying in the legislature, but do you have any thoughts of how that could be tackled from advocates' point of view? Is there any credible arguments that can be made? I have some ideas on that, but it would devour the program, so I didn't want to spend a lot of time talking about legislative advocacy. But it is really heinous when we have these lifetime statutes for people. So, are there anything that can help for advocates when they're in Denver talking to their state legislators?
Well, I think the argument that's come about lately is there's a shift, right? Where previously people were saying, this is punishment, registration is punishment. And that's what Judge Mache acknowledged in this case that we've been talking about. And there is even this, you know, there's this argument that it's cruel and unusual punishment, and that the punishment doesn't fit the crime, and that there's no specific designation. It's just a charge that subjects someone to lifetime registration. It's not the particular facts of their case or the particular facts of who they are as a person. It just locks them into this requirement without a particularized finding. So I think those are the things that need to be challenged, is that maybe there needs to be very specific findings as to why one particular person should be subject to lifetime registration, where most other people should not be, and to allow for people to move past things.
So, well, I hope that's helpful. I've shortened this interview because I want to try to take as many questions as we can. We've got 20 minutes. I'm going to switch it to question and answer mode. You will hear an indicator that you can press star six. I'm making that change right now. Get yourself in the line. And when I select you, I'm going to call out your area code and say that you are on and to ask your question. And please try to keep it focused on the deregistration, or focus your answer on Colorado law or deregistration process. We'll hopefully have time for unrestricted questions later. So I'm going to try to be a little bit strict. So we want to get to everybody, but I don't mean to be rude, but I want to get to everybody who has a question about deregistration or Colorado law. So star six will get you in the queue, and we're going to start right away. We're starting in Colorado with area code 720. You're on Narsil in Action.
Hi, yes. I had a question. I'm on a deferred judgment, and part of my deferred judgment, they said that I have to register for 10 years. However, the deferred judgment is only four. This conviction was 3 years ago. Does that still hold true, or after I've completed the deferred judgment, am I still required to register for six more years?
That's a really interesting question. What jurisdiction was that in?
Arapahoe County.
I actually don't think that they can do that. Certainly, you don't want to just stop registering, when you're done. But my suggestion to you is, I don't think that that's a valid plea agreement. And the second that you're done with that deferred judgment and sentence, the second the case is dismissed, I would file a petition to deregister, and I would think that it should be granted.
Okay, thank you.
Well, that was one of our fastest questions ever.
Yeah, I don't think that's a legal plea.
So thank you for the question.
Yeah.
I'm going to go to area code 757. You're on Narsil in Action. Go ahead.
I was convicted in 2000, and I was advised at the time, for incest, by the way, at the time I'd be registered for 10 years and I could petition, and I was released in 2004. But when I went to petition, they said I was ineligible. So my question is, was that ineligibility always there for incest, or was that a more recent law? Because I'm wondering if I am, in fact, ineligible.
That's a more recent law. And unfortunately, though, in Colorado and a bunch of other states, and they've upheld that under ex post facto. So basically saying that they can change the law after the fact and you still have to adhere to it. Again, the argument has generally been because registration has been a civil penalty and not punishment. Under the ex post facto prohibition, they can't add punishment after the fact. So that's how they're getting by it. But I think that some recent cases are really opening up this area for litigation where judges are saying, nope, this is punishment.
Colleen, I'm just curious. Caller, stay with us. I'm not gonna let you go for a minute here. What county was your conviction in?
It was in Jefferson County.
Okay, and I'm breaking my own rules, but since I'm the host, I get to break my own rules. we don't normally get into specifics of the case, but this is intriguing. When you did your plea, was the plea negotiations, did the fact that you would be able to petition for removal at the end of 10 years, was that a factor of significant weighting in your choice to do a plea?
It was for me, but it wasn't written into the final plea. I was advised beforehand, and the prosecuting attorney never brought it up to the judge, and the judge really just kind of glossed over it. So it really
let me sharpen the question. I'm trying to get to an end here, and I don't want to put words in your mouth. I'm assuming the attorney said, represented to you that you could file after 10 years because that was what the law was. And Colleen's absolutely correct that it's civil regulatory. The courts have upheld changing civil regulatory. But would you have even considered a plea if that option had not been on the table, because if you were to consider the plea, if the case was so astronomically strong that you would have pled regardless just to avoid a more horrendous sentence, what would your, if they'd have told you at that time, this is a lifetime offense, you can't petition, what would your answer have been? And I know we're looking retrospectively, but what do you think your answer would have been if you'd have been told that at the time?
Well, I absolutely would not have plead, because I didn't think that their case was overwhelming. I just felt like I was doing the right thing. But I would not have, I was 32 years old. I wasn't going to ruin my life, you know, for the rest of my life if I had a choice.
Well, because there in some jurisdictions and probably not in Colorado, if that was a significant part of the plea negotiations in terms of how the register was represented to you by defense counsel, even though it might not have been in the plea itself, we've had some luck with that argument, but we wouldn't be able to dissect it a whole lot further here. Maybe something we could talk about. I see you're not in your area code is up in the looks like the Hampton Roads area of Virginia, right?
Yes, I moved, and they won't let me deregister here because Colorado says I'm ineligible there, and so I'm kind of stuck.
There may be grounds sometimes for either withdrawing your plea or saying that you had ineffective assistance of counsel, but a lot of times those are time barred, so that's something that you might consider. And you have to be able to prove somehow that was part of the deal and that you wouldn't have made that decision otherwise, and those are pretty high bars to get past. So that's usually where we don't have a lot of luck, is we can't prove those things. One of the things that I always look for in somebody's plea agreement when I'm going over their paperwork is, you know, was there some kind of agreement in there that promised them something that wasn't possible?
So, well, it might be worth your while to possibly reach out to Ms. Kelly after the program and find out if there's anything on the table. I feel bad that this has happened to you, because it happens to a lot of people. They change the rules, or the lawyers, in fact, don't understand the rules, and they tell them things that are just not correct at the time. But in this case, it sounds like it was correct at the time. Thanks for the question.
Thank you.
So we're going to go on. Next caller is area code 845. You're on Arsenal in Action. Anybody wanting to get in the queue? There's only a couple left at star 6, and that will put you in where we can see you.
Hi. This is not a Colorado question, although I was originally convicted in Colorado. Is that okay?
Sure. Yeah, we don't have a deluge tonight, so go ahead.
Okay. So I was convicted in Colorado. Attempted sex assault on a child position of trust in 04, and moved to New York, got my probation transferred there in around 06, finished my time there in New York on probation. And recently, in the last year, I moved to Pennsylvania, and I filed a petition basically under Muniz to be removed. And apparently that's successfully going to go through on the 21st of this month. And however, New York is saying that I still have to stay registered in New York for their total term of 20 years. And they just sent me something I just got today, a requirement for me to go get photographed by the state of New York sex offender registry and saying that I have to go to the Pennsylvania police and have my photograph taken and sent to New York. So I guess my question is this legal? Can New York continue to compel me to jump through hoops and register and have my photograph taken and all sorts of stuff, especially after I get removed in the next week from the registry here in Pennsylvania? I won't be registered in my state of residence, but this other state that I'm no longer residing in, that I wasn't even convicted in, is still continuing to make me do things, you know?
Okay, that's a short answer. No, they can't. I mean, another state doesn't have jurisdiction over you, right? But again, the best practice is not going to be just to ignore something, right? Because their mistake is going to become your problem. So I'm not sure what New York law says or what law they think they're enforcing, but they certainly can't order, you know, they can't order someone in Colorado to do something if they're not living in the state, right? It's just an odd allegation, but I certainly don't want them to put out a warrant because you're not complying with this absolutely absurd demand. So I might contact someone in New York and kind of run over the letter with them and just maybe respond to it, you know, send some sort of proof and say, hey, stop sending me stuff. I don't live there anymore.
Hang on just a second. That is something that happens. Wisconsin is our favorite state that does that. When you leave Wisconsin, they tell you that you need to continue to pay the $100 registration fee and remit it and send them a form. And I'm telling people, same thing as Kelly just told you, is I don't understand how they would have a jurisdictional hook because it's a regulatory scheme, which you're no longer there. And I don't, but the only way we'll find out the answer is through a declaratory judgment action, usually, or some legal intervention. Because if you're willing to send the $100 in the case of Wisconsin, they're willing to cash your $100 check and keep sending you an invoice for it. I don't believe that they, I agree that they probably have no jurisdiction once you're no longer connected to New York to require you to do anything, but don't ignore it because the last thing you want is an NCIC warrant outstanding for you that would cause you a lot of grief.
Yeah. No, I'm definitely not going to ignore it. My question is whether I have, I guess what I would have to do is contact a New York attorney and, you know, ask them to, you know, help me, you know, draft something or do something in New York to even, you know, maybe ask them to, you know, or demand that they remove me from their records because I'm no longer, you know, a resident of the state.
So, well, all right. Thank you for the question. And I would advise you same to reach out to a legal professional and make expensive financial resources. But otherwise, New York may be a problem for you. And thank you for that question.
Thanks.
Area code 303. I know this area code quite well. You're on NARSL in action.
Hi. Yeah, I have an unusual question. I was convicted or pled guilty in 1997 to an F3, sexual assault on a child, in a position of trust. And when I pled, they told me that I would have to register once a year. Well, in 1998, the law changed, and I had to register every quarter. Is there any way that I could get back to registering once a year?
I'm sorry, this was in Colorado?
Yeah.
Well, that's actually interesting because the quarterly registration is, there's supposed to be some findings made. So I think that you can contest it, certainly, but that would be a really, really detailed review. So I'd be happy to you know, have a conversation with you outside of this recording where we went over the requirements and could let you know if it was worth it to go back and challenge that. You'd have to file with the court of conviction and ask them to change your registration requirements.
Yeah, it initially in Adams County was yearly, and then in 1998, such a long time ago, I had a 16-year probation that I successfully completed about 5 years ago. And in 1998, they changed it. So now it's just that it's 10 times more difficult to register that often. And I'm worried that it's easy to remember on my birthday, but four times a year, it's a lot more likely to forget or get busy and not know what day, because they don't let me come in any day I want. I have to come in on certain day, certain time.
And, you know, what did you say? The sexual assault on a child position of trust?
Yeah, F3.
Yeah, and that, again, there still should have been a hearing for you, I think, when that law changed. And I haven't dealt with it in this context. Yeah. So I think that you would basically demand a hearing and I think you'd be entitled to it. I think we can make that argument. I'd have to do a little bit more research, but I think that would be something that you'd be entitled to on the law change. Again, there's this idea of, you know, whether it was whether the law changed and whether there's a prohibition on the law changing without you knowing. But we can still make that argument. I think it might be worth it to look into.
So I'll reach out to Ms. Kelly and thank you for the question. We are going to probably take one, possibly two more calls. I'm giving priority to Colorado area codes. I see you in 847 and 812, and I'm going to get to you even if we have to get to you after the this first hour ends, but I'm going to give this next call to Colorado area code 720. You're on NARSL in action, but I will get back to the other two. Go ahead.
Hi. Yes, I was wondering, is there such thing as grandfather law? With because I had two accounts of sexual assault forced against will. They're both adults, but the first one I was not guilty of. I went to trial three times. Second one I went to bad mental health and alcoholism because I lost my kids, my children, and long story short, I ended up getting trouble over it and being what they wanted me to be. But anyway, I did my 10 years already, and I've done everything they wanted to, did my time, I'm done everything. Now they're trying to come at me with this lifetime registry. And I'm just not understanding that because all my paperwork that I have when I was released does not say nothing about lifetime. It says I have a date when I could deregister, and I did. And I did like four times already. They keep denying me. They're telling me I'm forced to do life now. I've tried to file a civil suit.
When was the conviction?
When was it back in 1999, 2000, 2002.
Okay. And how long were you, when did you finish your sentence?
I was 2007, and then they told me I could deregister June of 2017, right? Yeah, because I did it like four times since then. Now they're telling me I have to do it for life. And I'm like, wait a minute. I've been doing my paperwork and everything. And I'm finding it very difficult because, I mean, I've been turned down for housing. I'm on disability. I've gotten married. I'm trying to move on with my life. And it's been such a struggle. And now they're just trying to throw all this hardship at me, saying I have to do life now. And because I have no money to get help, you know, with the lawyer, I don't know what to do. So can they do that to me? I thought I'm under grandfather law back when I was released because I was never told nothing about doing life registry. I was told I might be doing life. I was threatened by many lawyers that used to come and see me in the jail back then, but.
Well, I can tell you, I can answer your question.
We're gonna have a very short answer here as we're gonna go to a hard break. This is a person who probably should reach out to Ms. Kelly after the program, and I would ask you to do that. And the callers that are in the queue, 847-812, we're gonna take you on the flip side after the 5-minute break. So do not go anywhere, and then we're going to have an hour of Can They Do That after we finish these calls, and then we're going to have a fun-filled hour about plea bargains for the third hour. So everybody, you are listening to NARSL in Action.